The number of people rushing around in ever decreasing circles, trying to make more money. Your career, okay, you get paid and you're rewarded for your work, but becoming a slave to making more and more and more money is, in many respects, counterproductive.
Hello, welcome to the podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn Louis Dispense Wisdom for a Career in Life. That's wisdom, not just information for your career and your life. My name is Duff Watkins, and I'm your host. Our guest today is Peter Thornhill, a 40-year veteran of the financial services industry. He's an author. He is a lecturer, presenter. He is a former merchant banker in London. He consults with the banks in Australia. And really, he's an entertainer. He consults with the major banks, runs numerous seminars. He is a financial commentator on the media frequently. My favorite quotation about you, Peter, is he assaults popular wisdom. And that's why you're on the show. Thanks for joining us, Peter.
My pleasure, Duff.
I was saying to you, this started 33 years ago. A mate of mine dragged me along to a seminar where you're presenting. And I was looking for some information about how to start investing, because I didn't know anything. And in Australia, as you know, it's property, property, property. You got to invest in property, property, property. And my mate said, no, I own property stuff. You know, first, you can lose money in property. Secondly, you know nothing about it. You need to learn more about the stock market. So we went along to your Motivated Money seminar. And it was very entertaining. Secondly, it was very enlightening. So let me say right now, I bought your book, Motivated Money. I recommend people to do so. We'll talk more about it. You also have a website, motivatedmoney.com.au, because it's in Australia. And I have subscribed to your newsletter for 30 years, and it's called My Say, always entertaining, sometimes infuriating, but always good value, not spam. And what I love about it, Peter, is it's regular but infrequent. So when it comes out, there's always something good to say in it.
And the reason I do it infrequently, Duff, is in the past, my experience with writing to a timetable, I wrote rubbish. I need to write only when I have something to say, not because I have to say something. So
I'm grateful. Peter, how did you get into this? I mean, you're in financial industry, very senior roles, but how did you make the transition into financial educator, if I can call you that?
By accident, Duff. When my wife and I got married back in 69, shortly after we got married, we saved up a little bit of money and we decided we'd go on a working holiday. And so we had bought one-way tickets, believe it or not. We spent 6 months in the US and then we're going to... It was going to be an 18-month working holiday. So we had 6 months in the US. We then were going to London for 6 months, Europe for 6 months, and then coming home. The interesting thing was we did not come back for 18 years. And it was that apprenticeship in England which totally altered the outcomes of our lives for the better. And so it was that apprenticeship in England where I was nurtured by far wiser heads, and eventually I was headhunted to come back to Australia. And when I came back to Australia, preaching what I had learnt in England, I was told, nah, you're wrong, you don't know what you're talking about, et cetera, et cetera. So I was forced to re-examine everything I had taken for granted in England. I discovered I was right. And that is what turned me into the monster that I am today. And if someone had said to me that I was going to earn my living through public speaking, I would have said, you're crazy. You know, I was as reluctant as most people. However, practice makes perfect. And as you say, you have to be an entertainer to be a good public speaker. And so I fell into it by accident and discovered at 53 years of age that my true vocation was public speaking. Odd, but a lot of fun.
And I want to point out too, you talk about investment, and how can I say this in an elegant way? You are a successful investor. I want to underscore that for our listeners and viewers. You're somebody that walks the talk, you practice what you preach, you make a point of, without being ostentatious about it, that your lifestyle is basically funded by your investment strategy. So you kind of remind me of John Maynard Keynes. He would spend half an hour in bed every morning with his personal investments and got very, very wealthy by it. Didn't overthink it, didn't spend a lot of time with it, just half an hour a day. And it paid off for him and it paid off for you. And it's paid off for me too, come to think of it.
Yeah, well, it's one of those things. You know, we had very modest beginnings. I was one of four children. My father was TPI, totally permanently incapacitated after the war. So my mother raised four children. There was no money. My wife is one of 10 children of an immigrant family that came to this country after the war. They had very little money. You had the father, the sole breadwinner, working on the Victorian railways, supporting 10 children. But I mean, there's a whole lot associated with that as well. In those 10 points you asked me about, choose your partner carefully. I was very lucky. My experience with all the public speaking, thousands of people that I have met over the years in those forums, and one things you learn over 50 years, two savers, nirvana, two spenders, spender, saver, disaster, because you're going to have one white-anting all the efforts of the other. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter whether it's male or female. You know, the guy's got to have a new four-wheel drive. He's got to have a bigger boat, blah, blah. The wife has to have a trophy home. So one spender, one saver. I can almost pick them in conversation with them, which mm-hmm. way round it is. I was lucky, two savers, and that's what transformed our lives, plus that apprenticeship in the UK.
Well, then let's get to the 10 lessons that it took you 50 mm-hmm. years to learn. Lesson number one, you can succeed despite your education.
Okay. I failed my last year at high school. So I finished high school in 1964. I failed my last year. All my grades in all the subjects were below the class average. I left school and was a bit of a loose end. Anyway, my father got me a job as a sewing machine mechanic in a factory where they embroidered sheets and pillowcases. So I was an apprentice sewing machine mechanic. I lasted there for probably 6 or 7 months and decided I could cross that off my bucket list. When answered a newspaper advertisement, so ended up getting a job as a clerk with an insurance company, one of the leading insurance companies here in Australia. And the progress from there, met, married, changed jobs briefly to work for a General Motors car dealership I doubled my income from $2,500 a year to $4,200 a year, saved up, took off on the working holiday, got a job in London as a clerk with the insurance company I'd worked for in Australia, then went to an employment agency, got a job with the Merchant Bank, Anthony Gibbs & Sons in London as a clerk. And that was the last time in 1972 that I have ever applied for a job. Every other job has come looking for me.
So about the education, so you transcended your limited education, I guess, is what I'm hearing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. So I actually, when I started work, I went back to night school and I ended up polishing off another three subjects. So I got the qualification and that was basically it. Never set foot in a university, but took off and worked hard. And as I say, a clerk, worked hard, got headhunted to go to another company, got headhunted to change jobs, got headhunted to move to Sydney, and it just went on and on and on.
Well, that takes us to lesson number two. And a lot of people will disagree with this, by the way. Lesson number two, whatever you do, if you do it to the best of your ability, you will be noticed. Now, a lot of people out there would say, well, you know, I'm working pretty hard and ain't nobody noticing me.
Well, they have to examine themselves. It's interesting, Duff. you know, over the years working in large organizations, the number of employees who hate their jobs. They're not paid enough, their boss is a monster, they don't like, blah, blah, blah. You have to transcend all of that and you have to stand out, be absolutely brilliant at one thing in your life. I mean, if you look around, the virtuoso performers in music, literature, arts, science, medicine are all famous. The majority of us are not virtuoso performers in anything. We're jack of all trades, master of none. So you have to become very good at one thing, and that's working hard, progressing, positive. It will work for you. If a company is looking for a new employee, they often go to an employment agency, give them the brief. So the employment agency will say, well, for example, with me, I was working in London and I was approached by a funds management company, Henderson Unit Trust Management, to join them. And the way that comes about is the employment agency goes to the users of whatever the product or institution is and says, can you think of people who work in this industry in this particular role that are good? So the employment agency harvests the names that are recognized by the industry. So you get mentioned in dispatches, you then become a candidate that they put up. And that was how all those job changes by invitation occurred. You become very good.
And what was it that you were doing well, Peter, that got you noticed? Because it's especially difficult for, I mean, I'm an executive search consultant, so I consult senior level recruitment. And a lot of people, it's difficult to get noticed because, okay, let's say in your situation, I'm imagining there are a lot of people doing what you're doing. How did you manage to stand out doing this stuff? By what means did you stand out?
Okay, well, the big breakthrough came when I was headhunted from Anthony Gibbs & Sons, the merchant bank, to join Henderson Unit Trust Management as one of their regional sales managers. So they moved me from London, where we lived, to the Midlands of England, office in Birmingham and Lincolnshire coast, all the way to North Wales. That was my patch. And I must have been a good salesman, Duff, because I wander into this patch where nobody knows me from Adam. I speak to the advisors, I promote our products, I give them, not incentives, I was doing with them what I was doing at the presentations here, mm-hmm. saying, look, you know, this is what we're doing, this is why we're doing it, how we're doing it, blah, blah, blah. And it seemed to work, because the sales in the Midlands of England shot up. Henderson said, hey, this is fantastic. We want you to come back to central London, take over London and the southeast. So in doing that, I was then approached by S.G. Warburg. They wanted me to become an expat back in my home country, Australia, because they had become involved with a stockbroking firm who had some rather moribund unit trusts. They wanted to lift that. So they wanted me to come back to Australia as the national sales manager. Amdenard thought, what the hell? So I moved back here. And so it was the same thing again. Success with that role, setting up regional offices in all the capitals in Australia, went very, very well. So all of a sudden, I get approached by another company who would like me to leave and come and do work from what was called Potter Warburg.
Yeah, I remember them.
I was approached by Perpetual Trustees who were taking their industrial share fund, which had been a trustee common fund, into the public arena as a public offer fund. I moved over, turned it from a $300 million fund to a $4 billion fund. I then got approached by another company to go and work for them and do the same thing there. So it was just one step after another. So I guess it was the sales side that worked really well.
I was just about to say, in my career, I've seen many times one of the fastest way to the upper echelons of senior management is by sales, through sales, being successful at sales. Because if you can do that, I mean, you'll always be popular with somebody if you can sell effectively.
But Duff, this is the secret of success in your life. We're all salespeople. It doesn't matter what it is, whether you are selling yourself, whether you are selling a product. It's you have to get up there and be out there being able to pitch.
Even now, our producer is nodding because he is a veteran sales guy and he's been saying this for years and it's so true. I think I've learned that myself. Now, let me go on to lesson number three, because I've heard this before and you've been discussing it. Don't stay in jobs you don't like. Now, a lot of people don't know that they're free to leave jobs they don't like.
That's right. And it's, as I say, this comes back to my earlier comment about the number of people in large organizations who don't like their jobs. They go home disappointed every day. They complain, et cetera, et cetera. They're never going to ever reach their true potential because they've put a lid on themselves effectively. You have to sell yourself. So everyone is a salesman, ultimately.
Tell me how you're using the word sales, because I want to be clear about this for people. So a lot of people don't feel they have the product to sell in themselves, for one thing. I think that's a handicap. The word sales is used liberally. So can you specify what you mean by that, Peter, when you talk about selling yourself?
You have to present yourself in the best possible way. You know, you go into a shop looking for clothing, and the guy behind the counter is, you're going to walk out. So you have to present yourself in the best possible way, positive, effective, and it doesn't matter what level you are at. There I was, a clerk sitting at a desk, shuffling paper. Somehow I was weaving magic and I got noticed and I got moved on and moved on and moved on. So it is a sales process. You have to think of yourself sounds crass, I know, but as a product, and the way you present yourself is going to have a huge impact on your potential career.
Well, it's not crass at all, I think. I mean, because it takes a long time for some people to learn that if you don't pay some attention, not all, but some attention to the way people perceive you, they are not in a position to be able to support your personal or professional endeavors. Now, I'm not saying you need to be obsessed by it, but at least pay a healthy amount. And that sounds like that's what you've done. And so you really pretty much worked your way up from the bottom, it sounds like. And I know that you're very streetwise about finance, and we're going to come to that right now. Now, first, I want to talk about when I read your book, when I hear your presentations, read the news list, your blog, one of the things that comes across loud and clear is that the share market, the stock market, which everybody knows about, some people are invested in, the share market is guided not by cause and effect, but by fear and greed. In other words, very human emotions. I'll just stop there. What's your reaction to that? How did you learn that?
Fear is based on ignorance. The reason people are concerned or worried or frightened by the share market is through ignorance. Knowledge is power. And the share market, unfortunately, because of its extraordinary liquidity, I can buy and sell the shares in, say, one company 50 times in a day. That is how liquid the share market is. The problem is that human behavior takes over and the share market becomes a barometer on a daily basis of the fear, the greed, the day traders, the short sellers, the hedge funds, nano trading, etc. And it mirrors that on an hour-by-hour basis, which feeds the media. And I mean, you may remember when I'm prime minister, I'm going to shut the stock exchange and only open it one day a year. Mm-hmm. You can all come in, trade your pants off, then bugger off, and I will see you in 12 months' time. Remove the liquidity, there is no volatility. But unfortunately, it's that volatility that everybody's focused on. And it's seen as some sort of casino. You place your bets and you hope you win or lose. And that is not what it's all about.
That's really true. I mean, because in Sydney, you go on Bond Street and you stand, you look at the ticker. You know, you can stand on the street and see the stock market change. And there will be a crowd of people literally gathered around watching. And it's like they're watching entertainment. And these are companies trading and selling.
But the hard part is that no one's encouraged to take the long-term view. And the majority of the attention is focused on the movement in share prices, which drives me nuts. As you are probably aware, the main thing for me is having the income to enable Frieda and I to do what the hell we like with
dividends,
our lives.
Dividends.
Dividends from these companies. And these businesses are there, and they are the engine room of the world. All these businesses all over the world are the dynamo that drives the human race. Businesses are there to satisfy our ever-varying needs. There's no risk associated with it. I mean, businesses come and go, but by and large, you invest in good businesses which generate profits and pay dividends. And so this whole wonderful process rolls on over and over and over again. And as their profits grow, they pay part of it to us as a dividend. They retain profits to invest in new technology, new product, et cetera, et cetera. And the reinvestment produces higher profits. They pay a higher dividend. They retain some to increase the business, et cetera, et cetera. And so this process rolls on. And as I raised in one of the other points, make money your slave. For so many people, they are slaves to their money. And you were saying, you know, they're watching, they're looking, they're reading, they're in front of their screens, they're on their pads, etc. They're nuts. I've got better things to do. At my stage in life, I'm semi-retired. I have a beautiful wife. I have five gorgeous granddaughters. The last thing I'm going to do is sit in front of a flipping screen.
And get anxious about it. And by the way, I want to say, you just reminded me, I came back in January 20, I guess, I was overseas, and I checked my portfolio, and I hit the magic number that I had set for my retirement fund. It was just the number that I had chosen many years ago. I hit it, and it was a big number, and I was quite happy for about 8 days, because then COVID came and everything drops, you know. And I'm proud to say, Peter, I didn't give a shit, because quite frankly, I have learned the lesson that it goes up, it goes down, it goes up, it goes down some more. And this actually fortuitous, we're having this conversation. This week, I hit that magic number again. And I'm not overly excited. I'm happy, but I'm not overly excited, because it'll probably go down again before I call upon it. And being able to handle that success, or that up and that down, that failure, that success, that's one thing that I think I've learned from your book, your work, others as well. You know, just don't get sort of overly excited, because there is a business process at work over which we have four-fifths and bugger all influence, from what I can tell.
Correct. And do you remember the global financial crisis?
Vividly.
Vividly. I was interviewed after the global financial crisis, and there were four of us on a podcast. Three of them were stockbrokers, and I was the odd man out. Quite why they had me on, I don't know. But anyway, the interviewer started off with asking each of the participants, so what do you think the Reserve Bank will do with interest rates on Thursday? And I thought, oh my God, how the hell would I know? Anyway, we stumbled through this process. And anyway, we got to the end, and the guy then said to each of the stockbrokers, okay, so what are your hot stock picks for this week? And I thought, oh, no. Anyway, luckily, he had sort of got my flavour. And he got to me and he said, so, Peter, what's on your wish list for, you know, next week? And I said, ah, oh, another global financial crisis, please. There was stunned silence. He recovered and he said, Peter, why do you want another global financial crisis? And I said, well, I'd like to buy some more Commonwealth Bank shares, which had fallen from $64 to $26. I would like to buy some more Wesfarmers shares, whose price had fallen from 42 to 13, because I didn't go hard enough the first time round. I love it when share markets crash.
Did you say, or did you write somewhere, there's no such things as panics, no such things as crises, no such things as crashes? Did I read that?
There are periods where we have a perfectly rational correction following a period of irrational behavior. History is my guide. I can foretell the future, Duff. History is my guide. And we have had throughout history periods of utter madness followed by a perfectly rational correction. We then build up from that to another period of irrational exuberance, whatever it might be, Bitcoin, whatever. We then have a perfectly rational correction to remind everybody of what the fundamentals are. And so it goes on throughout history, up, down, up, down, up, down. Utter madness. But human endeavor will never cease.
Point number four, you say financial independence is easy to attain. I always thought there had to be a lot of suffering involved.
Well, it depends on one's perception, Duff. I would have to say, looking back through my life, the 50, 60 odd years of work, it was relatively simple. I did what I did. I did it well, and I kept on doing whatever I was doing and doing it well. I married a saver. So between the two of us, there was a perfect match. We never spent all we earned. And so it was simply a matter of carrying on doing the same dumb thing decade after decade after decade and investing wisely. And I say investing, and it's important that we draw a distinction, because one thing that drives me nuts at present is the media and the way they use the word investor, investing and investment, totally in the wrong context. Investing. And the best I've found is in one of the books on my shelf here. It's the Modern Encyclopedia for Children. Mm-hmm. My parents bought it when we were kids. Invest, the use of money productively so that a regular income is obtained. Speculation, buying and selling in an attempt to benefit from a fluctuation in the price, sometimes in an anti-social way. Just remember that. Use of money productively so that a regular income is obtained, buying and selling in an attempt to benefit from a fluctuation in the price. And when they talk about investors in Bitcoin, honestly, I'm glad I'm not licensed to carry sidearms, because there'd be a lot of duelists out there.
I keep quoting Paul Krugman, who says he just doesn't understand the attraction of Bitcoin. One, it doesn't do anything better that current cash and current financial products already do. And secondly, there's no need for it. It solves a problem that doesn't exist. But what would he know? He's just a Nobel Prize winner. So
it creates a problem, Duff. The amount of electricity that is used to produce Bitcoin is phenomenal. They've been building new electricity generating plants to meet the demand.
Huh, I did not know that. Well, one of the things you describe about financial independence being easy, I mean, it sounds pretty unglamorous. It sounds pretty routine, sounds pretty mundane. And my personal experience, if I can just say, that's pretty much what it was. My maid, who took me along to your seminar, he very wisely, astutely observed that I was a lazy sod and I wasn't going to do too much tinkering and monitoring. And so I needed something that was really kind of idiot-proof. And solid, steady investing seemed to work for me. I didn't have to overthink anything. So
it's as boring as watching paint dry. But people think you've got to be on top of it all the time. Just, as I say, in one of my points, make money your slave, don't you become a slave to your money. Invest it in good, make other people work for you. Invest it in other people's businesses and get them to work for you so that you sit back and enjoy the fruits of their labor.
And they enjoy the fruits of your investing in them. So, well, okay, and that takes us, one way to do that is lesson number five, I think. Spend less than you earn, borrow less than you can afford. Seems pretty simple.
I would have thought so, but experience, 50 years has taught me, no, sir. What is concerning me presently, and I'm going to sound like an old retard now, there is a generation that expect to have everything today that it took my wife and I a lifetime to achieve. And in this headlong rush, the risks that they take and the price that they pay is phenomenal. Spend less than you earn, borrow less than you can afford. Doesn't work for most people.
Yeah, there is a magical thinking is what it's called in psychology. And my observation, and I got to say, I certainly see it a lot in Australia. Everyone's looking for the shortcut to wealth or fame or fill in the blank. And the shortcut, and you know, maybe there is one for some people, but they are statistical outliers. Or more to the point, sometimes, you know, you've heard of those overnight successes after 10 years of hard, solid, decent work. That's usually how it happens. I don't see too many shortcuts. I don't see too many genuine overnight successes. And in the financial process, I mean, with the stock market, correct me if I'm wrong, Peter, but basically you're taking advantage of compounding interest, which needs time to take effect. And compounding interest is, you know, one of the mysteries of the world. Even Einstein was intrigued by it.
Yes, this is the difficulty. People don't seem to understand that time will do the hard work for you through compounding. But everyone thinks they have to do lots of this, that, and the other. You don't. All you have to do is invest it in good businesses, other people's businesses, have them working for you. You get on with your life, becoming absolutely brilliant at one thing, making damn sure your family is rock solid and looking after all your close friends. Mm. That's all you do.
And the rest is window dressing, it seems. Well, okay, lesson number six. You've mentioned this a few times. Make money your slave. Now, can you elaborate on that, please?
The number of people rushing around in ever-decreasing circles trying to make more money. Your career, okay, you get paid and you're rewarded for your work, but becoming a slave to making more and more and more money is, in many respects, counterproductive. Money is my slave. It does all the hard work for me. I sit back and enjoy the fruits of the labor that money is doing, that those other people are doing for me, paying me. I am not a slave to my money. I enjoy the benefits it provides, and I love it because we can enjoy things that Frieda and I would never, in our wildest imagination, ever have considered. We now have that at our fingertips because money is our slave. I have made my slave work as efficiently and as effectively as possible, and hey presto.
Okay, so money is your servant and it's serving you. Now, people are going to want to know, okay, Peter, how do I do that? How do I make my money my servant so that it actually serves me and I'm not fretting about it and anxious about it and running around on those diminishing circles?
The thing that has sort of been uppermost in my mind in the last sort of decade or two is I have been buying shares ever since we got back to Australia in 1988. And over the time, I have built up quite a number of individual shareholdings. I am winding all those individual shareholdings back with the assistance of my financial advisor. I'm winding those back and I'm putting it into listed investment companies. That means, you know, without being morbid about it, if anything happens to me, my wife will inherit maybe five or six shareholdings in these beautiful listed investment companies. And these companies their business is not running a supermarket or making washing machines. Their business as a company is to own shares in other companies. So it's like a managed
fund. Yeah, yeah.
So I get exposure to 120 companies by buying shares in this one company. I don't have to think or worry, and I'm winding back all those individual shareholdings. I don't have to look at the share market ever. Ignore it totally.
Because they're doing it for you. I mean, you pay a fee for this, but they're doing all that fretting and running around and anxiety-induced activity. They're doing it. You're paying for it, but they need to succeed or else.
Yeah. But again, the fees associated with the old-fashioned, and I'm talking about old-fashioned stuff, my apprenticeship in England, when I left and came back to Australia, I was not sure that I wanted to leave my home. So I left my pension fund in the UK. Anyway, we ended up staying in Australia. And when the time came, I converted that into a pension fund. And it has four shareholdings, four listed investment companies. And the one I like most of all has only been going for 161 years. It has just celebrated its 55th consecutive year of dividend increase. Do I care less? So that is what I want, and I'm going to have here as well, is these old-fashioned listed investment companies. And I mean, one of the ones I use here in Australia, the management expense to me is 0.14%.
I mean, that's exceptionally low in my experience. I mean, that's lower than an index fund.
Yep. But this is the beauty of the listed investment company, because unlike most managed funds, they don't charge a management fee. The listed investment company is a board of directors, a small team of analysts. So the management company, or the management of the company, is it. Whereas ETFs, for example, they have a manager and they're charging a fee based on the value of the assets. These guys aren't. All you've got to do is pay the salaries of the analysts and the board running that company. It's not a percentage of the assets under management. So the larger the listed investment company in size, the amortization of the costs of running that company over a vast asset base, the cost comes plummeting down.
And what you're describing, you mentioned an ETF, that's an electronic traded fund. And just in case people don't know, but what you're describing is, I mean, people may not know the terminology, but none of this is rocket science. And I read your book, but I also read many more. And I reckon, and I'd heard this before, and I think it's true, for our listeners and viewers out there, if you read five books on investment, just five, any five, you'll probably know more than 80% of the people on the planet. And you'll have more than enough to start making sound decisions. It really isn't that complicated. It may be a little foreign because you're learning about things you were ignorant about. What I'm trying to say, it isn't complex and it isn't complicated.
No. There are loads of books. The problem is finding which ones. Actually, you may remember in my book, I've got the recommended reading list. And there are a handful of books that I have read over the years that I have found of value. But underlying it all is that apprenticeship in England.
Also, those books, pictures of them on your website, motivatedmoney.com.au. Now, let me go to point number seven, because I'm very interested in this one. Lesson number seven, rent your lifestyle. I thought I was supposed to own everything.
This is the problem. This is where a generation is going to get a very nasty shock. My current car, or our current car, is a 2005 Toyota Corolla, and it gets me from point A to point B. And we pick up our grandchildren from time to time, and they come and stay with us, and we have a lot of fun. However, I'm a petrol head, and I love cars. So couple of years ago, we went back to England to visit family and friends there. I rented a 66 4.2 British Racing Green E-Type Jaguar. We spent a week touring the gardens of Devon and Cornwall in that gorgeous E-Type Jag. I handed the keys back. Thank you very much. We were in France 2 years ago, and I rented a brand spanking new turbocharged four-wheel drive Alfa Romeo. I managed to limit my speeding fines to just one, and again, had a hell of a lot of fun and handed the keys back. There's a club of Ferrari owners here that will rent their cars out for a weekend. I think it's about $850 a day. I can rent a Ferrari F350, take my wife up the Central Coast for the weekend, burn the pants off it, come back on Monday, hand the keys back. I don't want to own any of this. I can afford it, and it's the same when we travel. I love fabulous chateaus in France, etc. I don't want to own it. You know, people buy holiday homes. I think, what the hell are you doing? I holiday in fabulous homes all over the world. So you rent the lifestyle, you don't own it.
Okay, so well, the car is easy, but how about other aspects of lifestyle? And I do appreciate the bit about chateaus. I'm just coming to me. We were in Europe a couple of years ago. My wife had us staying in castles. Castles? What's wrong with the Marriott? But it was fantastic. And I never would have thought about that. And I don't even know how expensive it was, but it was worth it. Okay, but what about, you got your normal person, you got your daily mundane life. How do I rent my lifestyle just, you know, without being exotic and just on a day-by-day basis?
Our lifestyle probably hasn't changed from when we were kids in terms of we eat three meals a day. However, we dine out, fine dining, love it. Enjoy fine wines, etc. Very good food. The real pleasure for us now is that Frieda and I had three sons. Two of them are married, and there are five granddaughters. So there's 12 of us now. Our lifestyle is taking the entire family to Santa's village on the Arctic Circle in Lapland for Christmas. And watching little princesses playing in the snow, riding in a sleigh drawn by Santa's reindeer, having snowball fights with Santa's elves, and taking them to a holiday in Hawaii. That's the lifestyle. You know, the day-to-day bit hasn't changed. Mm. We still shower, still wear jeans, T-shirts. You know, the fundamentals haven't changed. But it's all the wonderful bits of life that you can rent.
Those experiences you're talking about. And you remind me of a book. I know you're familiar with this. It's The Millionaire Next Door by Tom Gordon. Yeah. I read a couple of those books. And basically, he did his doctorate studying millionaires, and he found out pretty much they're like the people next door. You know, they're not ostentatious. They're not showy. You don't know that they're millionaires, multimillionaires. They just show up for work.
Warren Buffett drives old basic automobiles, does not run around in a bloody Rolls Royce or a Bentley or anything like that. Yes.
The millionaire lives in the same house he grew up in Omaha, Nebraska.
So we live in a modest apartment. But when we travel and we're out there in the outside world, boy, do we live like royalty. But we don't need a massive bloody mansion here to show people how wealthy we are. We don't need to drive flashy cars. Yeah, the millionaire next door.
Well, underlying this goes back to a point that you've made a few times is lesson number 8, choose your partner carefully. Now, other than choosing your parents carefully, that's an equally important task. When somebody is getting married, how do they choose their partner carefully on a financial money-based perspective?
Clearly, I was not aware back. This is one of the lessons I've learned over the 50 years. And it was something I took for granted. Frieda and I were both savers. It didn't matter how little we earned. We always saved. And so it's a matter of your courting, you get serious, you must have some inkling of the personality of the person you are potentially marrying, And maybe it's a topic for discussion. I don't know.
It's very much a topic for discussion. I used to do a lot of premarital counseling in my previous career. And I think you said something that's quite significant. Let's see if I can remember it correctly. If you got two spenders getting married, it may be okay. If you got two savers, no problem. But if you got a saver and a spender, those are two different financial perspectives. And that creates friction, maybe not incompatibility. Is that correct? Is that your observation?
Absolutely. Duff, the thousands of presentations I've done and talking to people, thousands of people afterwards over the 30, 40 years, the relationship is over whether you accept it or not. Because, as I say, one is going to go on white-handing the efforts of the other. So you're trying to climb the mountain and the other person keeps pulling you backwards, pulling you backwards, pulling you backwards. It must be, well, I think I can say categorically, it is demoralizing.
Yeah, it creates that negative loop of we're not getting ahead, we're not getting anywhere, it's we're stuck, and then you don't want to have the hard conversation about it.
No. So it's pushed under the mat.
All right, well, let's go to lesson number 9 then. Fear is based on ignorance. Don't be frightened, be smart.
This comes back to knowledge is power. Fear is based on ignorance. The reason people are frightened of the share market, and this is abundantly clear after 50 years in this industry, is because they don't understand it. All they see are all the flashing images, prices everywhere, all over the shop, and media commentary that is nothing short of disgraceful. You know, market plummets. You may or may not remember some of the headlines I've put in the book.
Oh, yeah. Only the dates change, as I recall. The market plummets. People, you know, it collapsed, and then it could be 1983 or 1793. It's all the same, really. It's just a clickbait, is the modern phrase.
Yeah. And the fear is irrational. So knowledge is power. Understand what it is, why these people are running these businesses for you, and acknowledge that human endeavor is never going to stop. So that if people say, so what do you think the share market's going to do? I say, oh, the future direction of the share market's upwards. What? When? It doesn't matter. If you look at any stock market graph of any country, developed country in the world, it's jagged and it's all headed in one direction.
Well, since inception, it's 10, I believe the figure is correct. It won't be off by much. It's 10.4% compounded interest since the beginning of the stock market to today. That's over, I don't know how many hundreds of years, but so, and it's clear if you graph it, it's on up, 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 and up with a lot of deviations in between.
And it's the deviations that provide all the, that's the clickbait. You know, why is it going down? Why is it going up? Oh, this, and everyone's got their theories. It doesn't damn well matter. Because if the share market is as risky as people perceive it to be, you're telling me that all human endeavor is going to grind to a halt and all businesses are going to collapse. You're going to grow your own food. You're going to make your own clothes. You're going to make all your bricks so you can build a house. You're going to go and chop down trees to make the wooden chairs and hello? Well, is the dynamo.
And I think you illustrated with the point of the Commonwealth Bank, which is, I believe it's the largest bank in Australia. It's an international player. Their share price plunges, to use the press word, but the management team is the same. They're the same yesterday as they are today. The business is the same. It hasn't changed in the last 24 hours. They're still the biggest bank in Australia with international reach. Nothing's really changed except that volatile share price, which is the perception. A lot of it's perception driven. Is that correct?
Perception is reality. Your perception is your reality. My perception is my reality. This enables two people to look at the same thing and see two totally different points of view. As I say to people, this is where divorces and wars begin. Same issue, different perception. Commonwealth Bank during the global financial crisis went from $64 to $26. Are you telling me that in the space of, I don't know, 3-4 months, Commonwealth Bank lost 2/3 of its business?
Impossible.
And please also understand, what's the famous quote? Most people know the price of everything and the value of?
Nothing.
Nothing. And what is it they follow? Prices. Because I have often invited people, I will give them the last annual report for Cochlear, the company that manufactures the bionic ear. I would like them to go away and read that annual report and come back and tell me what the value of Cochlear is. And I ask the audience to put their hands up if they would like to participate. No one ever puts their hand up because they don't. Most of them wouldn't have the expertise. Most of them wouldn't know what the hell they're looking for anyway. So what do they use as their guide? Share price.
Price.
What a waste of time and energy.
The difference between price and value. All right, let's go to lesson number 10. Envy no one.
It's a beautiful thing. Frieda and I cannot believe how beautiful our life is. We envy no one. I watch people driving down our local high street in their turbocharged Bentleys and their Ferraris and their Mercedes. I couldn't care less. I park my little Toyota Corolla in the same street. I shop in the same shops. I don't envy any of them. We have a life beyond our wildest dreams. Can't ask for much more.
So the social comparison, again, that's what it's called in psychology, looking at somebody thinking they've got more or they've got better or they've got fill in the blank, that creates that sense of unsatisfaction. I think that's what the Buddhists call, you know, you're no longer satisfied with whatever you have. Now you're unsatisfied because you're comparing yourself to someone else, which is ultimately a loser's game, unless you move to the poorest neighborhood in the country and then you walk around feeling superior, if that's the way you work, if that's the way your mind works. But usually it's a loser's game comparing yourself. So what's the takeaway for people there? Envy no one and instead do what, Peter?
Just make your life as beautiful as you can and appreciate everything that you have. I mean, it sounds crazy. Frieda and I would never have believed that we would be in the position that we are today. And here we are. And as I say, we envy no one. We look back and the memories we've accumulated over the years, as one gets older, those memories are pure gold.
I think what strikes me is, okay, you got this good life with you and your wife, Frieda, the three boys, the grandkids, you got plans, you've done things. And, you know, I don't hear any, you know, oh, I bought Google when it was low, or I invested in Yahoo, I struck it, you know, I don't hear any of that. Basically, you know, you're buying banks and industrials is what I'm hearing.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm not interested in the mining companies, and therefore I favour the listed investment companies that are predominantly industrial companies. Mm-hmm. Because as you will remember from the charts in the book, resources are way down the line because digging stuff out of the ground has never created vast wealth. It is manufacturing, technological and intellectual inputs that produce the tremendous value add that create things like the bionic ear. So the value add comes from all the add-ons, human endeavor, et cetera, not just going out and digging stuff out of the ground.
And once you dig it up and you sell it to the Chinese, whether it's gas or coal, you can't do it again. You know, it's gone. All right. Let me conclude with one last question. We've been talking about the things you've learned over the last 50 years, Peter. What is something that you have unlearned lately? And by that, I mean something you absolutely positively knew to be true then, but now realize is not the case.
Up until the year 2000, I was part and parcel of the industry. And I was presenting, as you would remember, And I would talk about balanced funds and reducing volatility, read the word risk there. The thing that I have unlearned is that volatility is not risk. Volatility is provided by the liquidity. The risk I see, and the thing I have unlearned, I don't want a balanced portfolio. You know, people ask me, do you just invest in shares? And I say, yes. Oh, that's, and I say, that's because I'm an ultra conservative investor. And they look at me like I'm mad. But the thing is, if I add cash, property, resources to my portfolio of industrial shares, it will halve my return over the longer term. And I'm not prepared to pay that price. And what frustrates me, and the reason I ultimately left the industry in 2000, was because I could no longer stand in front of people and tell them to do what I was no longer prepared to do. I don't want loads of cash in my portfolio. I don't want government bonds. I don't want property. I want industrial companies, businesses. I want good businesses, and get the lead out of the saddlebag. You mentioned the 10%.
Yeah.
Since I got back to Australia and started seriously beginning to accumulate wealth in 2000, the performance of my portfolio has been 13.5% per annum compound by simply getting the lead out of the saddlebag.
Okay, so volatility is not risk. But what about modern portfolio theory? I think somebody got a Nobel Prize for that, which says you got to have these defensive assets. You got to have cash, got to have bonds, got to have, you know, lead, basically, because when the market goes south, you need defensive assets to stabilize or something like that.
It was promulgated back in the 40s. And yes, you're quite right. They got Nobel Prizes for this piece of crap.
Was that Eugene Fama? Am I just pull that name up?
No, I can't remember the names of the guys. But this was designed purely to protect ignorant people from themselves. And the thing that frustrates me today is people now in Australia have compulsory superannuation. If they do not pay attention to where that's invested, they end up in a default fund, which will be a balanced fund. People sell balanced funds on the basis of reduced volatility. Yes, the volatility will be reduced. But the problem is that no one ever tells them the opportunity cost they're going to pay over their working lifetime, mm-hmm. having this lead in their saddlebag. We're talking in the millions of dollars that they won't have because they've had this rubbish to smooth the return. I mean, for heaven's sake, you're there for 40 years, 30, 40 years in super. Leave it alone and get into the asset that's going to generate the greatest return over the long term, so that by the time you hit retirement, you're up here, everyone else is down there, and you leave it where it is and you simply turn the tap on, and all those dividends now flow back to you as your pension. So no, the unlearn was that volatility is not risk, and modern portfolio theory is crap.
And not only does he assault popular wisdom, he assaults Nobel Prize winning economists as well. So that's why you've been on the show, Peter. I pretty much appreciate it. We'll close on that rebellious contrarian note. Listeners, viewers, you've been listening to the podcast, 10 Lessons It Took Me 50 Years to Learn. Our guest today has been financial commentator and educator Peter Thornhill. If you would like to learn more about Peter's book, please drop me an email. His book is Motivated Money. If you don't know how to get it, email me. It's podcast@10lessonslearned.com. Again, that's podcast@10lessonslearned.com. And I will find a way to get it to you. Peter has a website, motivatedmoney.com.au. And I suggest, I urge you to subscribe to his newsletter called My Say. It will be worth it. This episode is produced by executive producer Robert Hosry and is supported, as always, by the Professional Development Forum, PDF. They provide newsletters, webinars, podcast parties, anything you want, everything you need for young, rising leaders, and it's all free. You can find them at professionaldevelopmentforum.org. While you're at it, go ahead and hit that subscribe button, because That way you won't miss an episode of 10 Lessons That Took Me 50 Years to Learn. And you want to do that because this is the only podcast on the internet that makes the world a wiser place, lesson by lesson. Thanks for joining us.